You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Contracting out military work has been part of the American system since the Civil War. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have introduced an expansion of this process of privatization. Tasks formerly done by the military itself are now being sold off. Blackwater, for instance, has brought notoriety to the use of mercenaries, but less light has been shone on some of the other contractor work, on translations, intelligence gathering, and even working in food services or cleaning. These fields, too, have seen massive outsourcing. Prothap Chatterjee is a journalist and the author of Iraq, Inc., and he joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Prothap.
Good morning, Lorraine. Thank you for having me.
Can you give us some idea of how extensive this outsourcing has become?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, contracting has been part of the U.S. military system for centuries, you know, and weapons, for example, are produced by the U.S. by private companies and never really being produced by government-owned entities. Although the government did, you know, take control of those entities during the Second World War and what have you. In a good comparison of how things have changed is between the 1991 Persian Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq. So in 1991, roughly, and this is a rough figure, one in 100 people was a private contractor. Today, it's more like one to one. So for every soldier,
wow,
there's a contractor. Now, I say roughly because there are some statistics that say one in 20, but there's an official military statistic that says one in 100. So whatever it is, it's increased anywhere between 20 and 100 times. And so today, there are roughly 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, and there are probably about 180,000 contractors who do a whole variety of things, from the translators, who there's about 10,000 of them, to the food service and cleaning people, and there's about 50,000 of them. Then there's a lot of other people who work in construction and what have you. So these are not necessarily the people, the Blackwaters that have become so famous. We're talking about maybe 3,000 to 5,000 Western contractors that carry guns. Most of these people are not armed. Most of these people are not military, and they're not skilled for that matter. They're just, you know, food service people who might just do cleaning and chopping and that sort of thing.
Why has there been this exponential growth in the outsourcing of military tasks or military support tasks?
Well, a couple of different reasons, but one major reason is the fact that the U.S. wanted to go to war, and it didn't have a lot of soldiers. And the Republicans, particularly Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, didn't really believe in the draft. In fact, they've historically been opposed to the draft. So they wanted to go to war with a small, light, you know, fast-moving army. And their whole idea was that they could do this if they had the resources that the private sector had. And they really believed in the private sector. So one of the things that the private sector provided to them was sort of literally almost like FedEx, you know, instant, you know, delivery of buildings and food and that sort of thing. And so this is something that they thought would make their army, you know, work a lot more quickly and efficiently. In some ways it has, in some ways it's too efficient. In some ways, you know, in fact, this has led to a lot of fraud and problems like that. So this is a major reason is, you know, in order to go to war without a draft, you still need people for the kind of war that the U.S. military wants to fight or is used to fighting, you know, instead of almost like in columns and in a battlefront and what have you. That, in fact, is not the best way to fight the kind of asymmetrical warfare that, you know, the fight with, you know, Al-Qaeda has been termed, but that's the way the U.S. military goes to war. And so you have both these people who have a fierce belief in the private sector. Rumsfeld used to run a company whose name I'm blanking on, but produced NutraSweet. J.D. Searle is the name of the company. Dick Cheney, the vice president, used to run Halliburton at one point. So these people are great believers in the fact the private sector can do miracles.
Yeah, I understand that translation services are generally contracted out by the government. How has that worked out for the U.S. military?
It hasn't worked out very well. In fact, I'd say this is one of the least successful aspects of the military in terms of them and their mission, which is, you know, going and fighting a war in Iraq. In order to be able to fight in another country where you're not familiar with the culture, the language, you need people, you know, who will act as a go-between. Since particularly the U.S. military has no knowledge or skill set in Arabic or Dari or Pashto or Kurdish. They have more of a skill set, let's say, in German or Russian, and they've been preparing for 50 years for war that never really happened, or at least not at least the big hot war. There was a cold war that happened. So they have recruited people using a contractor, and because they need a lot of people, they brought these people in very quickly, and they've taken whoever was available. And that has become very problematic, because what they did, what they asked the contractor to do, was to provide as many people as possible as soon as possible. And they gave them an incentive. And the incentive was this. They said, if you provide so many people to us, you know, we'll pay you so much. If you provide us less than this particular number, we're going to actually fine you. So it's a bit of an odd way of doing things, but they figured that if they said, let's say the number's 10,000, it increased from 7,000 to 11,000 now. They said, we'll pay you, you know, let's say $1 for every person. And if you make 11,000, we'll give you an extra profit of $1,000, let's say. On the other hand, if you provide us one person less, we'll fine you for every person you don't provide. So if you provide 1,000 people less than that 11,000, you're going to end up making a loss. So there's a huge incentive to bring as many people in as possible. And then what happens, you go out and you recruit people who don't really speak one of the languages. Either they don't speak English, or they don't speak Arabic or Dari, the language you're supposed to speak. And this I speak of from personal experience traveling in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember, you know, being housed with this translator, and I, you know, at some point, you know, we had these, you know, these things saying there's, you know, incoming fire. And I said, well, how do you say incoming fire in Arabic? And he had no idea. I said, don't you think that's kind of important? And there was this look of panic on his face. And he rushed off to find another translator to say, how do you say incoming fire?
That's shocking.
It is shocking, but it's true.
And how does that, what are the kind of ramifications of that?
That's a good question, an important one, which is that if the translators don't know what the people in the general population are saying, they could misinterpret things, you know, and that's in fact a big problem. They might say, you know, these people are saying the weapon's over there when it's over there. And maybe that's being a little overly simplistic, but literally I've seen things like that happen where on TV, actually there was a documentary that PBS did, Martin Smith did, where he filmed these people, and later on when PBS was translating what people were saying, you could hear people saying, the weapon's over there, and they're looking over here, right? But since the soldiers and the translators weren't providing the correct information. And in this particular case, it wasn't because they didn't understand. They very much understood what was happening, and they didn't want to provide the correct translation because they didn't want to get into trouble with the people who were in that building who would have known they would have said where the guns were, and then, you know, maybe they would have been, you know, targeted in the future. Vice versa, I have a friend whose brother worked in Adamiya, which is one of the most conservative parts of Baghdad. And when his brother said to him, what were you doing there? He said, did you kill any innocent people? And his brother said, no, we never killed any innocent people at all. He said, well, how's that possible? You know, this is a place that you bombed and raided so many times. He said, well, I can tell you there were no that we didn't kill any innocent people. He says, because there are no innocent people in that area. Every man, woman, and child is a terrorist. So you have the problem of people who go in there with a vendetta. Now, I'm not saying that this is widespread, but it certainly has occurred, where people from one part of the country get sent to another part of the country, and they, you know, and you had in the case of Guantanamo, for example, a lot of people sending people to, you know, to prison with the Americans being flown out of the country because they were paid $5,000 and they wanted to get rid of somebody who was their enemy. So it's very important to have impartial, accurate translation. I think a lot of confusion and problems in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan is from poor translation or perhaps deliberate mistranslation.
When you scratch below the surface, that it's very scary. Now, some of the essential tasks of warfare are very mundane things like cleaning and cooking. To what degree have these kinds of tasks been outsourced?
Well, this is almost entirely outsourced, and I actually have a new book coming out in February called Halliburton's Army with Nation Books. A little promo there, but the book is primarily about how this has been turned over primarily to third world workers. So If you walk into a mess, into what was called a mess, it's not a mess anymore, it's very clean and efficient, at they call them DFACs now, dining facilities, it's an acronym, you will find that only one in 20 of those people in that facility, and this is an actual number, is a soldier. 19 out of 20, you know, so I'll give you an example. There's the Camp Anaconda in central Iraq, which is the main logistical hub. Almost everybody who works there is either from India or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh or the Philippines. And they come in and they're paid, you know, more than they would make at home to work there and cook and clean and serve food. So the soldiers no longer have to do that. And one of the problems I think they're trying to avoid is, as I mentioned earlier, the lack of soldiers. They have very few soldiers who are willing to go to war. But also because they want the soldiers aren't necessarily good cooks. You know, here are these 18-year-olds just come out of, you know, their houses, you know, don't really know how to cook a good meal. And don't want to, right? They don't want to go to, you know, war. And that's the most important part. They didn't want to go to war in Vietnam in the middle of the jungle. And they don't want to go to war in the deserts of Iraq where they have to peel potatoes. So you hire somebody and you pay them sufficiently. So for somebody who might make $100 a month in India, you pay them $300, you know, and you provide what becomes a very comfortable existence. And this is very critical, is a lot of these soldiers, like the people who come and cook and, you know, cut potatoes and what have you, are actually poor people. And they're doing this because they're assured of something. In terms of the Indian workers, they're assured of three times their pay and free housing and what have you. And in terms of the soldiers, they're offered, you know, the comfort food they would like. You know, they're offered, you know, McDonald's and Burger King, literally right on the bases. They're offered as much as they can eat, you know, pizza, Mongolian barbecues, so they go to war. So their job is to sit there, be fed, you know, clothed, watered, you know, cleaned up after, and all they have to do is pull the trigger.
Wow. How are these contract workers in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq? How are they recruited?
Well, they're recruited through a series of different people. There's, sometimes they call this sort of a pyramid. You have a contractor. The top contractor was Halliburton at one point. Now it's a KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary which is now a separate company. So they then go and hire another company, you know, an employment agency. They're several very big companies like this, like Prime Projects International is one of them out of Dubai, First Kuwaiti out of Kuwait. And they go and they're given a task. They're saying, they're told, we need 10,000 people. And off they go, and they particularly go to places like the Philippines. There's a province called Pampanga. It's one of the biggest provinces in Luzon. Or they go to West Bengal, to Nodia district. You know, they go to various other similar places. And they hire an intermediary there. In the Philippines, for example, it's a company called Anglo-European Placement Services, AEPS. AEPS then will hire individuals to go from village to village and say, we've got so many jobs going. I'm saying that somewhat metaphorically, because actually they don't have to beat the bushes. There are people queuing up outside the offices in Makati in the Philippines, you know, round the block, you know, looking for jobs in the Middle East. Not all of them realize they're going to Iraq. Some of them do. But this is also not something that's necessarily new. The Middle East is, in fact, a huge center for third world workers, particularly from India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and the Philippines. If you go to Dubai, for example, it's 70% workers from India. The population is 70%. The other 15% is, you know, Filipino and American and Canadian and what have you. But these are countries that are run almost entirely, you know, from, you know, cleaning the streets to running the hotels by expat labor. And that's a model that's been followed on the military bases in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And in fact, it's not necessarily completely new. I mean, they did this in Vietnam, and they do that, for example, in Yugoslavia. Although the interesting thing in a place like Vietnam in the 60s was they used mostly local labor, right? So it was not, you know, men of fighting age, but they used women, and they used, you know, old people in Vietnam. And there's some interesting videos you'll see on YouTube of these people coming in every day. But, you know, coming into work and then going home at night in their surrounding villages and places like Cam Ranh Bay. But today, I think they're much more worried that that could mean infiltration. So they want to bring in food service workers from other countries rather than recruiting Iraqis. So there's a contrast. If you go to Kosovo, and for example, there's a base called in just outside of Pristina called Banstil. And in Banstil, all the workers are actually local. But that's not true in Iraq. You go to Anaconda, there's not one person who speaks Arabic. In fact, most of them speak Urdu or Hindi. So it's convenient for me because I speak a little bit of Bengal. I speak quite a lot of Bengali and a little bit of Hindi, and therefore I can communicate with a lot of the workers.
And overall, how are these workers treated?
It depends on your point of view. So from the point of view of some of the workers, in fact, they're treated quite well. And the point of view of other workers, they're treated quite badly. So I'll give you an example that was in the news about a week ago. A lot of workers were brought by KBR subcontractor to the Victory Complex, the Baghdad airport area, very large military base. They were brought there to work on various military bases. However, something went wrong with the contract, and they didn't get the jobs they were assigned. So the contractor that brought them in was trying to save money. So you housed them in large warehouses and provided them with very little food. And they can't go work at those messes at the dining facilities. So they have to eat in their warehouses. So they were literally cooking food in open fires, living, you know, in a warehouse. So, and they started going, you know, protesting. And at some point, this report, I think, from McClatchy newspapers took photographs and started writing about it and saying, you know, what are these, you know, 1,000 workers from Sri Lanka doing, you know, sitting, you know, out in the middle of the desert in a warehouse? So in that particular case, and there have been lots of other cases of people, you know, being stacked, you know, 12 to a room and, you know, in bunk beds and being given, you know, slop to eat, not even realizing that they were coming to Iraq. Oftentimes, you know, the recruiter would say, well, you're going to Anaconda. And they would say, okay. You know, they have no idea where Anaconda is. They don't realize that Anaconda is a U.S. military base in the Iraqi town of Balad in the middle of Iraq. Some of them very much knew what they were doing. I don't want to characterize this as, you know, being, you know, where the conditions under which everybody works. I would say the majority of people, once they're there, know why they're working there and for whom, obviously, and are paid, you know, relatively well. And you can contrast that, for example, with working conditions in Kuwait or Dubai, where, in fact, depending on, of course, the base you're on, you could be treated quite well. You could actually live in quite nice accommodation where you might be a dozen people, but it'd be a big room. Depending, you know, it all sort of depends on who's employing you, how much attention, you know, the supervisors are paying. And again, a lot of people realize they're going to come and work in these conditions. Because if you're in Dubai or you're in Kuwait, you're also going to live out in the desert. And you expect to live 12 to a room and be paid. And you might be paid more in Iraq. So whereas, let's say, the average unskilled laborer in Kuwait might make $100 a month or less, the average unskilled labor in Iraq would make $300. So the reason I say this is because if you look at it as a relative question, you'll realize that a lot of people are full well expecting what's going to happen to them, yet they're willing to do it. On the other hand, there are people who've been exploited, whose passports have been taken away, who've been put into to housing, which is right on the periphery, on the wire, and have come under, you know, fire and don't have proper, you know, bulletproof jackets and what have you. So there is a whole range of accommodation and expectations as to what would happen to those workers when they got there. And some of them are desperate to leave. Some of them are more than willing to stay because they can save up a lot of money in terms of what they would have earned back in Luzon or Manila or Bangladesh.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I feel like we've just scratched the surface of this, but I really appreciate your coming in and throwing some light on the subject.
Well, you're very welcome, Lorraine. Thank you. Thanks, Prothap. I'm glad to be on Co-op Radio.
I've been speaking with Prothap Chatterjee. He's the author of Iraq, Inc. His forthcoming book is entitled Halliburton Army.